Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello, welcome to Asian Cinema Film Club. This is episode 104. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello, everybody.
On tonight's episode, we look at Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress, the much-discussed film which inspired George Lucas to create Star Wars. How much so? We will find out tonight. But before we get into that, it's time to ask, obviously, what you've been watching. And, Stephen, since the last episode, which was, obviously, the rather spirited discussion of the story of Ricky O, with Scott from the Church of Tarantino. Thanks again to him for coming on. But what's been honing your interest since then?
There's been a couple of things. One of them was a rewatch, which I rewatched because I was on the Lamb cast for the Valentine's Day. That'll date us for the Valentine's Day edition. So we were picking like rom-coms, and I was trying to pick some. Well, I didn't try and pick too many Asian rom-coms. There was a couple, but yeah, I rewatched sort of to support that, a film called The Beauty Inside, which I'm sure I've spoken about before, and probably I've put on one of our top 200 lists, but I can't remember. Only because I thought it's just a really interesting premise. So it's actually, it's one of those unusual cases where it's a remake of some American. I won't call it a film, more like a sort of Facebook web series. The premise is basically there's this fella that wakes up after his 18th birthday, and every morning he wakes up, he is in the body of someone else. And that someone else might be someone younger or older, or he might wake up as a woman, or he might wake up as an English person or a Japanese person. So it's a Korean film, sorry, I should say. So it, as you can imagine, it's quite hard to live your life like that. But the film goes out of its way to show how he, and he's very much a he inside. He's a fella called Woo Jin. You know, whoever he wakes up as. So it goes out his way to show how he'd cope by having a sort of a job where he doesn't have to leave the house, and he has all sorts of clothes and shoes, and he's learned how to be an optometrist so he can pull together whatever pair of glasses he might need to do this, and his best friend's in on it and his mother's in on it. But of course, one day he meets the lady of the girl of his dreams. But as you can imagine, it's quite difficult because every time, even though he stays awake for three nights when they first meet, he wakes up the next day and he's a woman. and anyway, surprisingly, they sort of get round this, and the humour comes from who he wakes up from every day. Obviously, it's been a Korean film, mate. You know exactly it's going to go into the realm of weepiness and... although it goes somewhere quite interesting. The girl who, I can't remember the actress's name, but she's fantastic. But she ends up on basically sort of mental health medication because it's so stressful. You know, you can imagine every time he comes to work to pick her up and he's somebody else, she looks like she's got a different date every night. And so that's putting a lot of societal pressure, and there's all kinds of things like going on. But yeah, I watched it. I've seen it before. It's really good. I really liked it. It was a little bit more weepy than I thought. Himself, he's played by 120 different people over the film, and 21 of them are quite famous Korean actors. So one of them, for example, is Ko, the girl from Snowpiercer, right. The young girl from Snowpiercer. So that's somebody, and you'd recognize, I guarantee you'd recognize 15 of them. They're just sort of mostly just famous faces, couple of stars. But yeah, really cool. So there was that. So I enjoyed that. On the other hand, I also watched a film called Oxhead Village. Now, we've never really spoken about the films of Takashi Shimizu, which is surprising because, you know, I think we base quite a lot of our history and chit-chat on that sort of J-horror boom of the turn of the millennium, because he was the director of Ju-on, which is a film I've never got on with. I do not understand why people love it so much. You'll be glad to know it's the first box set from Arrow, because they've just done one, haven't they, the first few Ju-on films, that I have no interest in whatsoever. Because as far as I'm concerned, he's a director that has really amazing set pieces that are in incredibly rubbish films that don't hang together. But I know people do love the Grudge films, and I know he's got his fans. He also was able to make a really boring live-action version of Kiki's Delivery Service, which I've never understood how he managed to make that boring. Anyway, when I started watching Oxhead Village, I didn't realise that he was the director, but I stuck with it. And so this seems to be the third in a sort of a trilogy, not in terms of story, but sort of trilogy of films which are all about spooky goings-on at villages, Japanese villages. Okay, so I think, I can't remember what the other two are called. Don't really much care because I'm not going to go and watch them, but I just happened to get a copy of this. Anyway, there's some really good bits in it. After a kind of impressive opening, where three young girls are doing like an Instagram live, and they disappear. We cut to another girl, schoolgirl, and this guy that's got the hots for her at school, and he shows her the video, and he says, but the reason he's showing it to her is, oh my god, this girl looks just like you. So she feels a bit weird about this, so she travels across the country with him to go and see what's going on in this story. And some nonsense happens about twins and some village with some villagers who sort of pray to a cow-headed god, and there are some really cool, just the sort of things that he always does, sort of things which look kind of spooky and creepy but are only happening in people's minds or in their dreams, and then suddenly they wake up with a shock and very little of it actually sort of happens in the real world. And the story itself is nonsense. There's some nice visual stuff going on. There's a scene where three characters spend, I swear, 15 minutes arguing at a train station in the rain about... I have no idea what was going on, mate. It was just naff, but I know people love it, and I suspect one day we should probably talk about Ju-on, because it is a kind of important film for that sort of Asian invasion, horror invasion stuff, but I just don't get it at all. You're going to tell me you love Ju-on, aren't you?
No. It's been a very long time since I watched Ju-on. Both the original and the American remake, I can't remember really sort of blowing me away. But, you know, with October coming up, then, and obviously this year's, how are we putting it, 30 Days of Torment that I put myself through every year, being horror-focused this year. Because we obviously did. We've done a director with Takashi Miike. We've done an actor with Anthony Wong. And now we're trying to do a genre, so we're doing horror. So chances are then we're no doubt covering it amongst that. So,
I mean, there are. Yeah, I mean, to be fair, he directed the American remake with Sarah Michelle Gellar, I remember. I remember it had a really stunning trailer. But that's it. And I haven't... There's sequels upon sequels and prequels and... Bless him, he's made a lot of money out of it, I'm sure. But and I know that people enjoy his movies, and there's probably more going on. I just was bored, rigid, but which is sad, because I didn't really want to say, oh, I've watched a movie and I'm going to dunk on it. That's not really my thing, but it has to happen at some time. So that's me. What about you, mate?
For myself, a couple of bits and pieces. Obviously, over on Movies and Tea, we're wrapping up the production of our Miyazaki season. So if by the time this comes out, it will be either in full flow or will be available. Just go and check it out over there on Movies and Tea. On a Miyazaki season, one of the last couple of films now. So I watched Ponyo from 2008, which is a film originally I did not care for. But now having watched it again, or perhaps just being in the right frame of mind, I actually kind of enjoyed it. It's got all the threat of My Neighbor Totoro, which may have been the reason I didn't really get into it before, is because there is no real threat to it. It's just this charming story of a boy who meets a goldfish girl who becomes a girl, and yeah, it's a very charming tale. I found for Miyazaki's take on The Little Mermaid, I thought it was pretty charming. Even Liam Neeson's pretty good as her father, and I thought it did some interesting things. It kind of taps into that same nature gods thing that we saw in Princess Mononoke, but obviously doesn't go anywhere near as dark as that one. Only this time it's obviously focused on the water, and we obviously have her father, who's a sea wizard, who's there to retain the balance in the oceans, and he's married to this gigantic sea goddess. So there's some really interesting visuals, and the last part of the film, the town that this is set in there becomes flooded, and we have this really nice sort of juxtaposition where you see this town where it's like, and it where it's flooded, and everyone's going around in little boats and things. And I kind of liked it. What's your sort of take on Ponyo?
I quite like Ponyo. I know what you mean. You're giving it shade, comparing it to Totoro.
I mean, as I said, with Totoro, I've grown to love over the years.
I mean, it's obviously one of my favourites, but I do know what you mean. It's kind of harmless. It's all about the sort of the wonder and the magic, rather than there being some great dramatic stuff going on.
Yeah, there's no threat in it. It's always there.
Not really. I mean, there's a little bit in the final act, and I think Ponyo feels, you know, the Little Mermaid is absolutely right. It is a spin on the Little Mermaid, and I think we've been spoilt. There are darker interpretations of that story. You know, there's fun things like Splash, isn't there? And then there's darker things like the Lure.
I was wondering if you're going to get to the Lure.
I love the Lure. I love the Lure so much. But I also understand why. I know a lot of people don't like it. But yeah, what's not to like about Polish man-eating 80s pop singing mermaids?
Because the singing parts didn't really work.
I loved it. But there's been others. I'm sure there was one in. Oh, isn't there one in the Masters of Horror series which is playing on that? I'm sure. Or maybe I'm thinking of some Japanese movie. But you know, it's a well worn. It's a story which has lots of interpretations, and the Miyazaki version is a nice and child friendly version. And I've got it here, so I must like it a little bit, because I have some. I'm not a fan of all the later films by him. I find some of them a bit dull, but it's charming. It's the sort of film you can put. It's a family-friendly film, isn't it? It's not like Princess Mononoke, that's for sure. Yeah, it's not got that sort of level of darkness to it. So I don't mind Ponyo. It's nice. Damning it with faint praise.
I mean, there's some real charming sequences, such as the old folks' home. I thought was really fine and charming. And there's a scene where. Obviously his windows in his underwater castle made of water, so there's a scene where all the crabs start coming in for the winter, which I thought was kind of funny. It's got this real sort of manic energy. And when you're saying like the later films, we talk about the Studio Ghibli catalogue as a whole, and obviously things like Tales of Mercy and stuff, which like the later ones, you're talking just like Miyazaki specifically.
No, I think as a whole, what's the one? The Tale of Princess,
oh, yeah.
Something or other. You know, I just think that's absolutely beautiful, but it's boring as hell. And I watched it with my niece when she was about 5 or 6 years old, and even it couldn't captivate her. You know, and it's kind of made for that. So I'm not such a big fan of what was the one about the aeroplane designer?
Oh, as the wind rises.
Yeah, that as well. Not so much, but as often with these things, you know, sometimes you need to go back and watch them again, don't you? I just don't like Studio Ghibli films by default. I've got some I love, absolutely adore. You know, and we've talked about a couple on the show, haven't we? Like Kiki's Delivery Service, which I was just referencing a little while ago. I love Totoro. I love Only Yesterday. I love... I really like that one we watched that was a pre-Ghibli one.
Oh, Castle Cagliostro.
I really like that. But some of them I do find a bit of a chore. I know. Gosh, I'm really hitting some sacred cows tonight, aren't I? Ju-on and Studio Ghibli. Wait till we talk about the Hidden Fortress. I'm going to get fired.
So, yeah. I mean, there's some ones that always get overlooked, like Cat Returns. Nobody ever talks about that one.
Mm.
And that was pretty charming. Ariarte is awful, though. So, I still don't...
That's the Borrowers, isn't it? That's the Borrowers
one. It's because nothing happens.
Yeah, how do I feel about... I don't mind Ariarte, but again, all I remember is it's based on the Borrowers, and I'd rather watch the old Borrowers BBC or ITV serial from the 70s than that. I don't know if you're probably just a bit before your time, but yes.
I remember the Borrowers.
Yeah, you know, that was nice.
Yeah, next up on my list is two films that I watched today, and they are both the same series. And that's The Executioner and The Executioner 2, Karate Inferno. The Executioner from 1974 is a Sonny Chiba movie where he plays a ninja who teams up with two other martial arts masters to break up a mafia drug ring. This is really kind of funny, goofy film. This is by the same director of Horrors of Malformed Men, Taro Ishii. I don't know if she's someone whose work you've come across at all, Stephen.
A little bit, yeah. Obviously, some of his stuff's come out.
Orgies of Eve, Edo, Inferno of Torture.
Yeah, that's right. I talked about Orgies of Edo, didn't I? Some 20 or so episodes ago. So I have seen bits of his work.
This one, I think you'd like, and both of them are kind of the same. Basically, you have Chiba teaming up with a ex-cop turned assassin and a mercenary to, as I said, take out this mafia drug dealer. In the second one, the same team are reunited to go in search of they get involved in a kidnap plot. They're kind of weird. On one hand, they've got like the same vibe as the Street Fighter, as there's lots of fighting and there's occasional moments of graphic violence. In particular, Sonny Chiba pulls out the rib of a guy. He punches a guy so hard in the back of his head his eye pops out. And he does the classic breaking of some guy's teeth. This is over the course of these two films that you have these random moments. We also have some insane dummy drops, including a jewel dummy drop and a scene in the second one where they seem to be seeing how many dummies they can drop over the side of a building. I think they get up to 5. But at the same time, they have this like real sort of slapsticky, almost Three Stooges-esque moments of humor to them. As one of the guys is like a pervert, they constantly playing pranks on each other. It's just a really weird blend of like martial arts action and slapstick that somehow works. And I just thought they were both pretty enjoyable films. The first one's definitely better than the third one. I would certainly recommend checking them both out. They are both on the Arrow Player. I believe that Arrow has put out a set of both of them. But I would say it's more just, I would see if you could rent them somewhere first rather than commit to buying them. I wouldn't say it's as essential as like the Street Fighter collection, for example. But no, it's always fun to see these early Chiba roles, especially because when he's just doing that Gorilla Man thing of like running around punching and kicking people.
Yeah, we're getting quite into old Sonny Chiba.
We are. he's like Anthony Wong. He's got this really interesting transition where he starts off as like the brute thug, and as he gets older, you see him like mature into playing like the gang bosses and like Ettore Hanzo. And with Anthony Wong, he obviously starts off as like scumbag gangsters, and has now finally got into like the aged mentor figures and. More like always playing more mentor figures now, isn't he? So, whereas his career is sort of more clear to see that evolution with Chiba. I think because his films haven't had the same sort of distribution that like Anthony Wong's movies have, that it's a little harder to see that gradual evolution. I think that if we had access to more of Chiba's work, but no, I'm definitely all for bringing more of Chiba's work to the show, definitely. So, this may be one that we look at further down the line, but I certainly had a lot of fun with it.
That sounds cool. I will. I'll probably be checking it out. Yeah.
Apparently, he's in Iron Eagles 3.
I've forgotten about the Iron Eagle films. Oh, classic.
With Lewis Gossett Jr.
Well, of course.
I'm just on his letterbox now. I was just curious to see what else he's been in, because obviously he's been in a lot of Drek, but like those early ones, you know, like Triple Cross and Killing Machine, those sorts of things are fun. But no, as I said, like Iron Eagle 3 is right up there at the top.
I would never have known that. Well, I didn't even know they made a 3. I do remember they did a sequel.
I'd never seen any of those movies.
Been a long time since I've seen them.
Yeah, that's what I've obviously been watching. I've got a bunch of stuff that I'm still trying to get cleared off the watch list, especially because some of my subs are drying up, so I've got to make sure I cross them off before I lose them. So yeah, it's been a bit of a random week. I've also like on, because I've been binging a lot of Arrow Players, so I watched like Angel and Avenging Angel, which is the one about the high school student who's also a Hollywood hooker.
Of course. Oh, yeah. You mentioned it before we recorded, and I was thinking, oh, I don't know what he's talking about. Now you've just said that.
The first one is pretty fantastic, because it's like she has to like track down this serial killer who's preying on the local prostitutes. And then the second one, she comes back. She's went away, and she got off the streets and became a law student, and her mentor gets killed, and she has to go and hunt down the mob-esque figures, but teaming up with the street folk to take them on. It's not as good. But the first one's pretty phenomenal. As sleazy as the premise sounds, it's actually not as sleazy as you may think, and instead it's kind of like a fun revenge thriller. Well, on that note, then, I guess it's time to fire the projector for tonight's feature presentation, which, of course, is The Hidden Fortress. So, The Hidden Fortress, released in 1958, directed by Akira Kurosawa. This is the second time we've done a Kurosawa movie on the show. Obviously, the first time one we did was Seven Samurai, and now we looked at The Hidden Fortress and other of the stand-up films in his filmography, along with the likes of Yojimbo and Ran. That's the Rashomon. One I was trying to think of, Rashomon.
High and Low, yeah. I mean, he is the preeminent Japanese film director. Him and Ozu, I guess, are the two that everyone probably has heard of or seen or knows a film title of, something
it's
like that.
It's funny, though. We only really look at half of his filmography. Because we obviously look at like a lot of the samurai stuff, and we look at Ikaru being another example. But you look at the other films on here, like One Wonderful Sunday, Rhapsody, August, and even like The Quiet Jewel. We never seem to mention those films at all, but it's more the early work that always seems to get overlooked, and really the focus seems to just purely be when he starts making like samurai movies like this film and Sanjuro that people sort of like take an interest in his work.
And it's the Bill Nighy film that's Living, that's doing the Oscar rounds at the moment. That's based on a Kurosawa film, isn't it? I can't remember what it's called. About the guy that finds out he's going to die. And the famous scene Ikaru. On the swing. Ikaru. Oh, sorry, yes, you already said it. Yeah, so that literally, as we speak, a version of that film is doing gangbusters. So, he's a really influential director. But I think you're right. I think everyone remembers... You know, we fell into the trap at the beginning. It's Seven Samurai. It's Rashomon. It's Hidden Fortress.
It is. It seems to be the thing when you think of Kurosawa, you just think of like art house samurai movies. And I think it's only sort of furthered by the fact that the likes of George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola are big fans of his work, and certainly the two came together to executive produce Keiji Musha. Or The Shadow Warrior, which for my money is one of my favourites of his filmography, but one that very rarely gets talked about. Who knows, maybe we'll cover it in a future episode here. Just one of a very long list of films that we have lined up.
it's a never-ending list.
Like the cleaning of a house. The film, though, it follows two Japanese presents. Presents? Can't get the words out tonight. For two Japanese peasants who have failed to make a profit from a tribal war, and they find a man and woman who they believe are simple tribespeople hiding in a fortress. What they don't know that one of them is a general and the other is a princess, and they basically agree to accompany the pair in safety in return for gold along the way, with the general having to prove his expertise in battle while also hiding the identity of himself and the princess. This has been well documented. It was the key inspiration for George Lucas's Star Wars. Stephen, did it sort of stand out for you where Lucas ripped this off, as people would like to often claim when they talk about Hidden Fortress?
I'm going to be honest with you. Although I know that he was inspired by this, and I know there is a draft of Star Wars which is much closer to the plot of The Hidden Fortress, I've got to say, it's not like, forget about spaceships and stuff like that, right? But basically, as far as I can see, there is the two peasants in this story are clearly what he's based R2-D2 and C-3PO on. But they are not the guts of the Star Wars story like these two are. And there's a general idea about rescuing a princess and delivering her somewhere. And the princess is quite sort of perky and spunky. But she, you know, Princess Leia, and I can't remember the name of this princess. But, you know, the whole point of this princess is that she can't talk and tell anybody who she is, where... there's none of that. There is a kind of Darth Vader analogue. So we've got Toshiro Mifune's character. There's another fella that's also like a general from the other side, and they have a kind of where they have a fight, but then they get on later on. Do you know what I mean? I think it's a bit of a stretch. I think there's plenty of other things that have inspired him. If it's the story of a few people taking a princess from an enemy territory to somewhere else, I think there are lots of movies that do that. I don't know. Am I being too defensive of George Lucas? Which isn't something I do very often. But I didn't see like scenes stolen from it or entire characters stolen from it or anything like that. There's a general... I get
have you ever
it.
Seen the short George Lucas in Love? It was passed around on the internet back in the early days of the internet. And it basically... supposed to be explain how George Lucas found his inspiration for everything, where he meets this girl who's right. like he uses the basis for Leia, and at the end he finds out it's his sister. But while we obviously view Kurosawa as this sort of like emperor who ruled over his sets and managed to create this incredible star at Mifune, while also being like known as this creator of samurai epics and darling of the art house. I mean, by this point in his career, he had basically burnt off any goodwill that he had with Seven Samurai, which was done in 1954. And by 1958, he's sort of like in danger of losing his career. Because first you got I Live in Fear, which is a melodrama, which is very sort of fraught with nuclear anxiety, and then he rebounded with Throne of Blood, which is his Macbeth adaptation, and then he decided to follow that up with his riff on Gorky's The Lower Depths, which managed to just basically do no favours to anyone. So by the time this film comes along, he knows that he's the only way he can get himself out of it is by creating something that's going to resonate with the audiences and get him some box office money, so that he can obviously still have a career. And in many ways with this film, he's really sort of taps into his love of John Ford westerns, and in doing so gives his sort of take with The Hidden Fortress. What's your feelings on this one, Stephen? Because it's a long movie, isn't it?
When you were given the precis, yes. the description of the movie, you in one sentence described the first 50 minutes of this film. I think that's my struggle with it. It is a long movie, and I knew that going into it. And it's really well made and really well acted, you know, and it's very widescreen and all that. But I think it takes an awful long time to get going. I think there's an awful lot of setup of the two peasant characters that, and then they spend ages with the general before they start going on the sort of quest, which is like the second half of the movie. And I think, yeah, so I do feel it's a little bit bloated's not quite the right word, but do you know what I mean? It just takes quite a long time to get going. And I struggled with it. And then I've sort of read up on it afterwards, and I do feel people don't like to say it, but I don't think I'm the only person that thinks that. And there's quite a lot of sort of even contemporaneous reviews that talk about this as being a bit of a second tier Kurosawa that's probably got a bump from its, you know, its relationship with George Lucas and Star Wars, and that people maybe think a little bit more of it. I don't know. Am I being too harsh on it? That it's a bit boring to start with.
Well, I love the fact that even though Lucas like gives it such high praise, that the Criterion Collection of Hidden Fortress, his basic introduction to it is, it's not at the very top of my list, but I liked it. Which is really high praise for a film that you like, you cite as this key inspiration for your own work. Right off the bat, though, we have these two fascinating. We have these two great characters who are these two peasants who are basically trying to turn a profit in this world, which is caught up in various wars and civil tension. And their main motivation is gold. All they want to do is to try and turn a profit, and in particular get gold. So They themselves are very easy to manipulate, because all you need to do is just basically promise them gold and they're more than happy to go along. And Mifune's general character basically does that for a great portion of the film. And they sort of stumble into each other, these three characters. The two persons they manage to find this bit of wood that's been hidden with gold, and in turn they meet Mifune's general, who recruits them to help with to helping him, in turn like promising him this gold that he's been hidden in all this wood. And he shows him his hidden fortress that he has, in which has this great scene where he has them where they're scrambling up the side of this mountain, and they look over the top and they can see his hidden fortress, and they like, then they see he's come down, and they look, because they look behind him and he's disappeared, and then they realize there's a second path that they didn't need to scramble all the way to the top of this mountain to get to the fortress. So there's these fun little charming sequences with them. And as you said already, we've got this really sort of spunky princess played by Amise Uehara, who is more than capable of handling her own, and she's also equally frustrated by the fact that she has to hide out and for the opening push in this film pretend to be a mute, which does provide the great scene where these two peasants think that she's a mute and are basically revealing how they're going to go and rip off the general with his gold. And the large push of the film just seems to be more about shifting this gold than it does actually hiding the princess. I don't know if you felt the same about this.
Yeah, because she, I mean, there's some sort of, no one ever really, we're in the age before photographs and things like that, so it's not really that hard to hide her. The only thing that's going to catch her out is herself, right? And you know, they go to a go to Mos Eisley. Sorry, they go to a cantina, and you know, she gets quite upset that one of her people is a prostitute, right? And so she gets a bit hoity-toity and insists that they bring this person with her on their journey, and that's the sort of thing which is going to catch her out. And you're absolutely right. Most of it is around how. So there's all this gold. So it's all the gold from her. So her people have lost a battle, and they've managed to save all the gold, and they've hidden it all in bamboo or something, haven't they, in wood. And yeah, and gold is relatively heavy, and so the thing is, how can they move as much gold as possible back to her ancestral kingdom? So the second half of the movie is them doing that, and then things will happen that means some of it might disappear and some of it might get lost, and how much of it can we grab back? And the two peasants, will they just run off with it any time? I do quite like the fact that they're never redeemed. they never change, do they? Whatever they go through, they don't suddenly have these moments of realization thinking, yes, we're going to do the right thing now. No, every turn, they're going to run off with that gold, or whatever situation they get put in, the gold comes first. I do quite like that.
It's very much the case, though, is that everyone else has these arcs where they're discovering things about themselves. The only thing these two discover is the fact that they really like gold. If anything, if they could be compared to any character in the Lucas universe, it would be the two pixies from Willow. Who I think are basically on the same level as these guys. They're also idiots. So there's a scene where they think they're going to they can move the gold by hiding in with this group of villagers that are traveling nearby, only for it to turn out the fact that they're going to a fire festival, and they think that they're carrying wood for the fire festival, which is then down to Mifune to basically push this cart of gold into the fire, which they have to then go and salvage later. But everything, a lot of the things that they do, they're there for basically to carry things, or to draw attention to the fact that of like local soldiers. That seems to be like their whole arc in this, is for them to carry things, want gold, or expose their ruse to people.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah, they're not. They're the point of view character, I guess. That's the idea. But they are. I don't think you ever grow to love them, do you? They're not even lovable rogues.
I mean, I like these two characters, even in the like moment where they. They're basically deciding which of them gets to have their way with Princess Yuki while she's asleep. Which again always brings that wonderful question of Asian cinema's approach to the subject of rape. It's always played for laughs, really, isn't it? And it's like, yeah, that's not funny, guys.
and I don't think it was funny then. I don't think we can even say, no, it was the time.
It's such a weird scene. It's like one of us will take a walk. So,
yeah, they're not. They're not heroes by any way, shape, or form. let's just be honest about it. But on the other hand, I did enjoy the princess. I thought. With shaky start, right? Shaky start. Because this quite horrible what happens is that, yeah, she's hiding from the conquering army. And basically her sister is passed off as her and executed. That's horrible. With all this wacky, poor peasanty wackiness going on, that happens. And then, yeah, so no longer she's a bit stern. But actually, she's the one who has a character arc because she actually, you know, you talked about that fire festival.
Yes.
And it's some kind of sort of, again, it's sort of like this villagers and they're just having a wild old Guy Fawkes night, basically. And she really gets down and enjoys it. And she says at the end of the film, that was one of the greatest things I've ever done. So I liked her character because at least I felt the things that happening to her impacted her and that she was a different person from the beginning of the film to the end of the film. But yeah, the peasants, they don't change over the whole 2.5 hours.
No, but I did find that that her presence on the screen was the same as Anime Wong. Whenever she's on the screen, you're just constantly drawn to her, and it may just be the fierce eye makeup that she has, but
I think she's got some amazing makeup. She also dresses, it's a very, you know, we're quite used to seeing Japanese princess type characters at this time being in a full-on kimono or some amazing hairdo or something like that. When she's basically wearing sort of a tunic with her legs bare legs. That's kind of unusual if you think about other films we've seen. You know, she's quite almost tomboyish.
She's basic. Yeah, she looks very much like the basis for any time you see like female ninjas, like in Izumi or Taki in Soul Calibur. She's got the same sort of getup as those sort of characters. So she's almost like a basis for like the female samurai or female ninja sort of character. Really, in the way that she dresses. And I mean, this was her first role. And she only had a brief career, because her career only stretched from like 1958, where she makes Hidden Fortress, and goes through to 1960. And over the course of that film, she makes about 8 films. Right. Most noteworthy being, obviously, Birth of Pacific in 59 and Storm Over the Pacific in 1960. But.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't come across her before, but. I thought she was easily my favourite character.
She is, and it's surprising that she didn't actually have more of a career coming out of this. I mean, obviously, she's playing off against Mifune, who is also rather great in this film. And this is actually, he's less of the madman that we saw in Seven Samurai. In this one, he's sort of like the stoic general. And has this sequence where he meets one of his rivals who's ahead of one of the other clans, and they have this duel which he betters him in, and because he leaves him alive, that when we see this his rival, like, later on, and he's been sort of like beaten and scarred in the face and stuff, and he feels this almost like regret that he didn't kill this guy. But it's a really fantastic duel that these two have with spears. Yes. Which is also not an easy weapon to have a duel with. So, and it's all shot with such a wonderful long, wide lens as well to it as well. So, those particular scenes I have, and it's kind of surprised me the fact that when people say that, oh, this is an action-packed movie, and it's really not an action-packed movie. If anything, it moves at a steady pace, but it's certainly not an action-packed piece. I mean, how would you describe the actual viewing, really, then?
I mean, to me, it's a bit of comedy. I think there's a lot of comedy in there, punctuated with dramatic moments. You know, like I said, there's some really dark stuff, like the princess's sister. Well, I guess it'd also be a princess being sent off to get killed. The stuff in the bar when they sort of there's the sort of young sex worker that they rescue, that's kind of dark. There's the, like you say, the fight scene. There's a lot of people running around, well, not running, riding around on horses at great speed, and you know, there's a lot of that, isn't there, where a bunch of samurai and horses will go past them and then come back again. That happens at least three times. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I think there's this huge comic element to it with the peasants. You know, you described it again, you know, like when there was the quick route down to that hidden also the hidden fortress, right, is done and dusted in the first 40 minutes. That's why is it called the hidden fortress in English?
It's not what you would describe as a fortress, really. It's more like
just a shack.
Yes.
A shack in a valley. A shack in a quarry, really.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
It's definitely a quarry rather than a valley.
But it's got, yeah, I think it's a drama, isn't it, that's got elements of comedy, elements of quite good dramatic intent, but it's not an action movie. It's not got, I mean, I guess, you know, when we watched Seven Samurai, there was a lot of drama, but it had this big action set piece at the end, right, or the second half of the movie. There isn't. There's the one fight scene that I can remember, which is what you've described. Everything else is after the fact. You know, great battles have happened. Or, you know, at the beginning of the film, we know that there's some stuff has happened. And there's some, again, even in the comedy, you know, what they've done is have to bury hundreds and hundreds of bodies of people. And there's another funny bit, isn't there? Like, oh, God, not again. We've only just started. They have to end up getting caught and have to bury some more bodies. So yeah, it's a weird one. I think it's a little if people haven't seen it, and I hadn't seen it for a long, long time, mate. You know, I didn't really. I it's almost like a first time watch for me. It's that long ago. I mean, I've got the Criterion edition that I bought back in the day. So that's, you know, I must have watched it in the early 2000s somewhere. So it's been probably 15, 20 years since I've seen it. So it wasn't the film I thought it was going to be. And I don't want to sound like I'm dissing on it, because I'm not. It's really quite good, but it isn't Seven Samurai, and it isn't Ran, and it isn't High and Low, in my world.
No, I don't think this would be the one that I would recommend people start with. I mean, for myself, I would start up with something like Yojimbo first, a film which itself has been remade numerous times. I mean, it was, it was made as Last Man Standing with Bruce Willis, and I want to say it was the Clint Eastwood movie. I try to remember which one now.
Sorry, I can't remember.
I think it's
I can't help you.
Fistful of Dollars or A Few Dollars More, one of the two. So.
Okay.
Well, I just ran that. So, yeah, it's funny when you mentioned, obviously, about the princess, the fact that people are so willing to, like, send themselves off to be executed, this sheer devotion that she sparks in people. And it's funny when you compare this as well, the fact that even in, with Phantom Menace, that Lucas was still borrowing from this, because that has its own fake princess subplot, doesn't it? So
And again, yeah, that is the thing. The Phantom Menace has got far more stuff ripped off from this than
yeah, thankfully no one's saying, Star Wars has. Are you an angel?
Yeah. And you know, if you're going to steal from the best, as you said, and you know, George Lucas has got many influences. He liked a Saturday morning cereal as well, right? And I'm not, lots of things I can criticise George Lucas for, i.e. unimaginative directing, but having Jesus, every one of his films just has every scene transition is just a swipe from left to right. Oh God, I hate it. Again, I'm shitting on some sacred cows, aren't I? Right, this episode. But yeah, no, it's you know, like every, as we talk about it, I'm remembering scenes, yeah, and things that, oh, actually, that was quite good. Oh, I really enjoyed that. But I'm not convinced as I sat and watched it, and I had to watch it in two halves, although probably in a more comfortable position than you were watching it. I it was a struggle, surprisingly so.
Yeah, when this is originally, this is another of his films which was edited down, because originally when it was released in the United States, it was released a 126-minute cut, and that was cut down to a 90-minute cut. I can't help but think, would a 90-minute cut this be a much more enjoyable experience? Would we lose something by hacking it down to the 90-minute cut? Because I know that certainly with Seven Samurai, I for years the only one I saw was like the shortcut, and then obviously as film appreciation has grown, the cut has now been replaced with the longer cut, which obviously has the intermission between. So that's why when we came back to Seven Samurai, it felt like a different film in many ways, a much more slower paced film, seeing it with that longer cut compared to obviously the shorter cut that I'd sort of grown up watching. So
I think I'd be interested in checking that out. Maybe that's on the Criterion Blu-ray. I just haven't noticed it in the special features, because I can see how stripping quite a lot of the first bit of the film out would make it a much more exciting. Nah, that's the wrong word. Exciting is not the right word. It just pacing it different and probably more better for home viewing. Does that make sense? Because I think there's a lot of, I said widescreen earlier, and that's maybe not quite the right phrase, but there's a lot of cinematic stuff that's going on. Lots of wonderful big shots that I don't think, even with our lovely 50-inch televisions or whatever that people have, I think this might be a film that's going to look amazing at the cinema. But at home, you're not getting the full majesty of it, and it's quite long. People love this film, though, right? I'm sure it's not, can't just be me having a go at it. I feel very, very, very strange today talking about the film in this way.
People do love this movie. At the same time, though, do people rate it so highly because they're afraid of like saying they don't like it? Do you think that in some way that it makes it seem as like a more, I don't know, that we're not, that somehow dimmer as a viewer, as a moviegoer, not able to appreciate what Kurosawa is doing, and that such highbrow critics were so keen to praise this film with. This why I do.
Oh, do you mean is it like a case of Emperor's New Clothes? I don't think it's that bad.
I just wonder, so like when you see people heaping praise on this movie, and it often feels like they're just drawing random praise out rather than actually talking about the actual movie itself. I just don't see it as this incredible life-changing experience that I think a lot of people have. It was certainly an enjoyable experience, but it's not one that I'm sort of rushing back to repeat viewing of.
Yeah, it's a really solid 7 out of 10 with some really great moments in it, right? But even if you look at it in context of Kurosawa's films alone, it's second division stuff. And maybe there's something about its availability, maybe it's its sort of pop culture reference, you know, to Star Wars, maybe brings it up in the world a little bit in people's minds. I think, you know, does Kurosawa automatically get 7 out of 10 just by having his name on the film? Is there a bit of that goes on? But, you know, I don't, you know, we talk about something like Rashomon. Is, you know, that's a byword for a certain sort of film now. We talk about Seven Samurai, that's a byword for a certain sort of film, right? And then you look at some of the epic stuff like Ran, yeah, is true cinematic greatness. And just because this guy did this film, that, you know, and it is well made, it is well acted, and there's some brilliant scenes in it, but I do think it gets an instant seal of approval, and maybe that it doesn't always deserve. We're going to be very controversial tonight because I think you're feeling the same as me. This is a solid but unspectacular movie, right? That's got some pretty cool bits in it.
Pretty much it's exactly, it feels very much like that. It's the fact that it's good, but it's not essential. That's the basically what I'm sort of feeling with this one, unfortunately. So,
I don't take it personally, even though I chose it at all, because I think it's interesting that we both come at it the same way. Because I was thinking you were going to say, "Oh my god, this is fantastic," and I'm thinking, "Shit, I'm going to sound like a bit of a Debbie Downer on this." But no, it's everyone should at some point in their lives watch it, but I think you put it nail on the head. I don't think it's, you know, if there's five films by Kurosawa to see before you die, I think this is at number 11.
If anything, it makes me want to go back and look at someone like The Silent Jewel, one of his earlier films, and something non-samurai related to maybe this, that, or Ikaru, just to see him work outside of it. Because so far, both of the films of Kurosawa's filmography that we looked at both been in the samurai arc, so it'd be kind of interesting to see something outside of that, which is my point. He might go net with our next jaunt into Kurosawa's filmography, but yeah, you go into it, especially like one of these well-known ones, you expect it to have like an experience like watching Pale Flower. There's going to be this experience that sort of sticks with you, and instead it was okay, but as I say, it just didn't, it was almost like Tokyo Story in a way. It's sort of like, yes, that was an enjoyable experience, but I just don't see myself when I'm going to return to this again. I felt that I got everything in that initial viewing without needing to go back to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're just talking around that we both feel very similar to this movie. I'm glad we've talked about it. I think there are things in it that I will remember. It sounds like we both like the same thing, the princess and her character. I think we both like the sword fight, the spear fight.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I like all these characters, and I like the various arc. It's just how it all comes together. At times it felt like a little plodding in places, and could have done with sort of turn up. But each of these characters' individual arcs, and if you just like their own path, have all got some interesting elements to it. I mean, as I said, the relentless greed of the presence, the general sort of arc, and obviously the princess is sort of like feisty nature, which obviously causes the group her own problems. But the fact is, it's not really a cohesive group, is it? It's just a group of people that are sort of thrown together rather than a group of people on the same journey.
And nothing comes of it. I think that's the thing. You know, the relationships that they have when they come into the movie. Yeah, the two peasants are obviously friends. You know, and they're quite bickery with each other. And but I never felt either of them would stab each other in the back. They're quite close. And obviously, the general is absolutely committed to the princess. The princess is committed to her people. But when we get to the end of the film, the peasants haven't changed at all. All they still want is gold, and they haven't become better people, have they? I don't see them going off having more adventures like this. The general has. There is a lovely sort of bit at the end, isn't it, where all becomes real, and it's very similar to the scene in. They're on their knees in front of the princess and the general, and you know. They've got caught trying to steal the gold, but they kind of get away with it with a bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge on everyone's part, saying, "Well, thank you for helping. Here, have one piece of gold," which is more than enough for them, to be honest with you. They're quite happy with that at the end. But it's not like the end of Star Wars, is it? Where this new gang has come together, this group of people have struggled through thick and thin and become friends and allies that would die for each other at the end of it. These people are never going to meet each other again. The princess has grown, absolutely. She's understood more about her people. That's it. And I think if you go through 2.5 hours of movie, I want more character growth. This, to me, you know, if you read it as like a manga or something, a multi-part manga, it may be a little more, I don't want to say bearable, totally the wrong word, but that's kind of what it felt like. Just lots of little vignettes that were linked together, but there's no grand arc there.
Yeah, I think that's it. I just, as I said, just don't think whether we're just in the right mind space or what, but it was good, but not great. So, for myself, I gave it 4 stars, so kind of hated it too much.
Yeah, I gave it 4 stars as well, sort of a solid 7-8, but it's all about, am I going to rewatch it again anytime soon? No, it'll be another 20 years before I probably watch it again. It's too much else to watch.
Indeed. And on that note, it brings us to the end of tonight's episode. Thank you as always for listening. Please do let us know your thoughts on Hidden Fortress. Let us know
how wrong we are.
Feel free, send us a spreadsheet. And you can get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. You can send us an email, which is acfilmclub@yahoo.com. And if you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to be listening to us. You can also check out our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com, which has got our full archive of episodes, including our chapter by chapter breakdown of Battle Royale, Fiend Months, so Anthony Wong and Takashi Miike, and there's just a host of other fun stuff on there as well. It's my turn to pick next, Stephen, isn't it?
It is.
And I'm going to choose a film which I keep failing to watch, and I really should watch because I'm actually a big fan of this director. And I'm going to go with Park Chan-wook's Decision to Leave, which has been on Mubi for a while, and despite me being saying I'm going to totally watch this day one, have failed to watch it since. So,
okay, I've got it. Interesting. I'm not going to say much more, but I bought it. I own it because I do like these Mubi releases, and I do flirt with cancelling my Mubi subscription, so it's something I want to see. But yeah, I'll be very interested what you think about it. Another long one.
That's fine. But yes, as I said, I'm going to use the show to get me to watch this bloody movie, as I did with The Handmaiden as well. And that was a delightful experience. So,
and I think I used when we watched Thirst, so
Park Chan-wook.
This doesn't really sound good when we have to use the show to force us to watch his films. But
he has a selection of films that we're just holding in reserve as well. So he's a director, sort of key director of Asian cinema, for South Korean cinema. But we have a very odd relationship with him in that we won't talk about Old Boy and Sympathy for Mr. and Lady Vengeance, but we have to bend our own virtual arms to watch The Handmaiden or Decision to Leave or First.
I tell you, when we get to our next milestone episode, so when we get to 125, we would do the whole of the Vengeance trilogy, and then we can just say, there it is. There's your Vengeance trilogy. We're happy now.
But we do have... It's a really odd relationship we have. I know there's other films, you know, that we've talked about doing and that we are saving for various scenarios. But the fact we haven't picked any of the three Vengeance trilogy... Because I think in our heads we want to do them at the same time, right?
That's basically what it is.
I think we've thought that since, like, episode 25. I think it's always been in the... in the background. We will get round to doing it. And we did give people the opportunity to vote for it, but no, they wanted us to
do... They wanted 9 hours to see on Sunod.
Indeed. Which, you know, good film there as well.
That was good. That's a really fun one to do the Hate trilogy.
Absolutely. So I have no problem. It's just weird, because he is a director, Park Chan-wook, that I like a lot. I think he's visually amazing. I have other issues with him, but we'll talk about this next week because it's a film I want to watch again. So I'm glad you've chosen it.
I know you said you wanted to discuss it once I'd seen it, and this seems like a way to do
absolutely
the thing,
so. Yeah, it's and it's got, you know, another couple. It's got one, you know, one of our favourite actresses in it. So I'll be interested to see what you think of her in a Korean film, in Tang Wei. Cool.
So that's obviously coming up on our next episode. But until then, thank you for listening. Thanks to my co-host Stephen.
Pleasure as always.
And we will be back next time to talk about Decision to Leave. But until then, good night. Hey.
昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が砕けちっても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.